Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders. Last year, along with John Nichols, the great progressive journalist with The Nation magazine, I wrote a best-selling book called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. In it, we tackle the issues that you don't hear much about in the mainstream media, from the extraordinary wealth and income inequality that our nation is experiencing, to the growing labor movement, to corporate control over the media itself. If I must say so myself, this is a very good book, and it's just been republished in paperback. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.
One of the interesting things about the book is that every chapter, I would say, has a pretty substantial section on something going on around the world,
right?
On comparisons to other countries, interviews with people in other countries, and I want to put this in perspective. When you ran for president in 2016, the first time you ran, you were in a debate, and you were talking about Denmark. And your opponent, Hillary Clinton, who you get on with pretty well on a personal level, but she said at one point something, and I hope I'm paraphrasing this correctly, who cares about Denmark?
Not quite, but close.
Yeah. And you can't, so you don't agree with that perspective.
Well, look, here is the point. It's one thing for somebody to spout utopian ideals, right? Mm-hmm. We want this and we want that, and it doesn't exist on the planet. Somebody said, hey, you're a little bit crazy. It doesn't exist. Many, not all, but many of the ideas that I talk about, they exist already. In fact, I remember there was an ambassador from one of the Nordic countries who said, Bernie, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but in my country, it kind of be more or less mainstream. In other words,
you would be boring.
Boring mainstream guy. And I said, God, I wish that they will come here in the United States. So in America, when we say healthcare is a human right, oh my God, Bernie, you're trying to change the whole world. It can't be done. It's impossible. Oh yeah, well, it exists in virtually every other major country on earth. And you know, we have talked about media and what media covers and doesn't. I live in Burlington, Vermont, 50 miles away from the Canadian border. Canada, in many respects, similar type country than the United States. You go to a hospital for a month in Canada. John, when you leave the hospital, what do you pay?
Nothing.
You pay nothing. You go to the doctor, any doctor you want, nothing. They spend half as much per capita as we do. So it is not a radical idea. British system is different. Danish systems, they're all a little bit different. But healthcare as a human right is not a radical idea. I talk about a very radical proposal, make public colleges and universities tuition free. Oh my God, Bernie, can't do this. The world is coming to an end. How can you possibly do that? Country after country around the world makes their public colleges and universities tuition free. I have the radical idea that 0 through 4 in human life are probably the most important from an intellectual and cognitive point of view. That's what the psychologists tell us. And I have the radical idea that if mom and dad are out working, maybe these kids should get quality childcare, right? Inexpensive quality childcare. Radical idea, can't be done. Well, it's done in many, many countries around the world. So the point about looking at other countries is to try to learn what is working and how it has improved their society. So as you well know, they do these surveys, was it every year?
Yeah.
What they call a happiness survey.
Exactly.
And, you know, fair enough that happiness is a very subjective definition. All right, issue. But time and time again, people in Scandinavia are always, whether it's Finland, Denmark, Norway, whatever it may be, at the top of the list. Why is that? Well, because they don't worry about healthcare. Well, they don't worry about education for their kids. Well, by and large, they don't worry about retirement security. They have governments over the years which have created a social net, a safety net, that is infinitely stronger than what we have in the United States. So it is terrible. terribly important to look around the world. You know, when I was a mayor, we used to follow what other cities were doing to steal any good ideas that were there, you know? That's what you do. And as a nation, we should be looking at other countries to see what systems they have, whether it's healthcare, education, that are working well, and not be afraid to incorporate them into our society.
In the book, we talk about those happiness studies. And it's kind of disappointing as an American to see that we don't rank as well as we should.
And what is one of the reasons? One of the reasons is that, and again, we don't talk about this very much.
As
in our country, people live under enormous stress and enormous anxiety. You know, if you're earning, if you live in paycheck to paycheck or worse, you have to struggle every day. You worry about how you're going to take care of your kids. You worry how you're going to pay the rent. You worry how you're going to pay the health care bills. You know, the rent landlord raises his rent. Where you're going to live, how you're going to get your kid into another school. It is incredibly stressful. Life is incredibly stressful for low-income and working people. And that is one of the reasons why our life expectancy is so much lower than for many other, in many other countries, especially for low-income and working-class people.
And we make a lot of these comparisons in the book. But we don't make them casually, I would suggest. There's quite a bit of effort to bring in voices from other countries and people. One of the things that we did in putting the book together was to arrange for a Zoom meeting with the education minister in Finland, Li Andersson, who is a young mom, which is kind of a cool idea right off the bat to have a mother with kids in school or a parent with kids in school who's overseeing education. And I remember that conversation that we had with her for the book. I think you were pretty amazed at times at all the things that they were doing and all the ways in which they were trying to make sure that it was an equitable system.
Well, not only that it was equitable, what they understand, which is absolutely true, is if kids are going to learn, they have to be excited and want to learn. They can't be bored to death, which is the case in many classrooms throughout this country. So their job was to make sure that kids are excited, feeling good about what they're doing, and the learning takes place on top of that. And it turns out that on international exams, if I'm not mistaken, they're usually at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And they start kids off at school later than they do here in our country.
Because it isn't just that you're kind of, you know, having the kids there so that their parents can go do something else. The concept is the kids go into a great daycare system, right? And then pre-education, and then they go into school, kind of starting when it's right for them to start learning, when they can start taking things in. But also, their school days are shorter, right?
So they start later,
yeah.
And their school days are shorter. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, they're not into homework very much.
No, they don't. They try to avoid ladling the homework on, so the kids can go and actually be involved in sports and culture and all sorts of other things.
And they end up at the top of the list in terms of international exams.
And one
so
the,
what do we learn from that?
Maybe it's worth checking out.
Maybe it's worth checking out.
The other thing, the one other thing that that Li Andersson and her her aides and staff suggested to us is that they make a major effort to educate about democracy.
Yeah.
And about being
that's
a
right.
citizen.
That's right.
And that's something that is of value, right? In fact, one of the things she said is that they actually teach young people that there may be points at which you need to protest, right? You need to dissent and raise questions. And at this point in America, we've got governors in some states that are taking out, getting rid of the interesting books and trying to say, oh, you know, you got to fit within this narrow zone.
Right.
One of the lessons I think that comes from the book is that there are examples from around the world that you can go in opposite direction and create a very vibrant, not just education system, but society.
Right. Look, I think what Lee was talking about is their goal is to have a vibrant democracy. That means not a docile democracy. Well, I'm going to get out of, you know, off my couch and vote every 2 years. But how do I participate in society? And that is something that kids have to feel at a very young age, that it is their country. They have a right to voice an opinion. They have a right to protest. They have a right to be involved. And that is something certainly that we do not do anywhere near enough.
In a bigger extent, one of the chapters in the book, we bring in some work that you've done, conversations you've done with in the past with the ambassador to Norway.
Yep.
Where you talk not just about education or not just about healthcare, but at the broader sense of a social welfare state and the role that that plays.
Yeah, and it's and we had a tremendous, I can't remember, and millions of people actually tuned into that. And I think people are desperate to hear what the corporate media doesn't tell us. In other words, it might be interesting, it would seem to me as a citizen, to learn what does it mean to live in a country where healthcare is virtually free, higher education is virtually free, childcare is virtually free, and yes, you may have to pay more in taxes, but you're proud of it because you have created a society that you feel really good about. Gee, can we learn anything from that? There's virtually, you know, every now and then there is some programming about it, but nowhere near enough. But I think there is an enormous amount to be learned from some of the wonderful things the countries around the world are doing.
And this is valuable in another sense, because so often the United States' role in the world is sort of seen as trying to tell other people what to do and not necessarily respecting where they're coming from, maybe when they get something right, but also putting a pressure on them. And I remember one of the remarkable moments in the, again, in your first campaign for the presidency, you were in a debate in Milwaukee and the name of Henry Kissinger came up. And your opponent said, oh, I'm gonna take counsel from Henry Kissinger. I know a little about him. And you shocked a lot of people, I think, because here we had so much of our media, so much of our political class, revering this individual. You said something there that was kind of profound.
Well, look, I grew up at a time when the war in Vietnam went a long way to really, the word destroy might be too strong, but really had a very, very negative impact on my generation. We lost friends and family members. People came home from Vietnam hooked on drugs, sleeping out on the street, severe mental illness. It was a devastating time for my generation, the young people who fought in Vietnam. And the fact that we got into that war because of a lie, the fact that we got involved in a civil war in Vietnam that we should never have gotten involved in, the fact that Kissinger went even further than Vietnam and started bombing Cambodia, which led to, political destabilization that allowed Pol Pot to come to power, who ended up with killing some 2 million Cambodians. I mean, the horror of that. The fact that during that period under Kissinger and Nixon, Salvador Allende, somebody who I've always admired very much, president of Chile, duly democratically elected, was overthrown by a military coup and Pinochet and his fellow fascists came to power, tortured, killed thousands of people, not to mention overthrowing governments for a period of time all over the world. So I think it is important to understand how destructive, in many respects, American foreign policy has been, not only in the Vietnam period, but in the so-called, war on terror, where we got into a war again because of a lie. We were told that Saddam Hussein, a two-bit, tyrant, bad news guy for Iraq, to be sure, but he did not have weapons of mass destruction, despite what we were told, got involved in that war. My son's best man at his wedding got killed in that war. Afghanistan got involved in that war, and Taliban is back in power. And right now, of course, we're supporting the right-wing extremist government of Netanyahu in Israel, who are in the business of preventing food coming in to help starving children. So I think what foreign policy has been about is a consensus, generally speaking, Democrats and Republicans coming together, wrong most of the time, but with the strong support of the military-industrial complex, which you'll remember at the end of Eisenhower's term. What did Eisenhower? He warned us about the power of
his farewell address.
And he was right. Today, you have these guys, a half a dozen major defense contractors making record-breaking profits, providing arms all over the world. People can go out and kill each other. When we talk about, you and I have talked in these programs about corporate media. That's certainly one issue that we don't talk about. It's not, well, is this decision right or is that decision right? It's you trace the decision after decision, war after war after war, almost always wrong. Always wrong. And the suffering that it has caused our people, again, my generation in Vietnam, and the people of Vietnam, and the people of Cambodia, and the people of Iraq, and the people of Afghanistan, is unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. But what is even more unbelievable is how often do we even discuss that?
That's it. Yeah.
We have a bipartisan foreign policy consensus, which is almost always wrong. Mm-hmm. And maybe, just maybe, we might want to rethink that. And that takes you to, right now as we speak, a military budget of $900 billion. By far, the largest discretionary part of the discretionary budget. More than half of everything we spend in discretionary spending is for the military. And the company's making huge profits. This is the Pentagon, is the one agency of government never having been able to undergo an independent audit. Massive fraud, massive cost overruns, who cares? You have people out there worrying that a kid is going to get, you know, $5 more for a lunch program. We've got to investigate that. But no one is looking at the fraud and the waste and the abuse taking place in the Pentagon. It's just not an issue that we discuss. And one of the things, by the way, in that regard, to get off topic a little bit, what I proposed recently is that we have a Truman Commission. You remember the Truman Commission?
We should tell people about it, right? Harry Truman, as a relatively unknown U.S. senator, was sent out during World War II. To go look at, you know, what the military industrial complex of that time was doing, and what he found was a lot of bad behavior.
That's right. He said their corporate greed has no end. I think that was the exact quote.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the case right now. So what I think we should do is bring back another Truman Commission and ask these companies why they are charging us such outrageous prices for the weapons. While they do all these stock buybacks and make all kinds of profits, it's something that's long overdue.
Well, there's another point where you tried to crack the sort of bipartisan consensus recently, and it does relate to some of the things we talk about in the book because, you know, it's how Congress works. And you said, look, we should investigate whether weapons that are coming from the U.S. are being used to do horrific things in Gaza. And senators did not rush to join you in that process or in that effort to investigate that question.
Well, what we did is a couple of things. Because I am extraordinarily upset about what Israel is now doing in Gaza. I mean, we all know that Hamas began this war. Hamas is a terrible terrorist organization. They killed 1,200 innocent Israelis. They took several hundred people captive. Absolutely outrageous and unacceptable. But what is going on now is with U.S. weaponry, Israel is not simply at war with Hamas, they're at war with the Palestinian people. And, you know, we all know what the statistics are, 32,000 Palestinians dead, 70-plus thousand wounded, two-thirds of whom are women and children. One of the amazing things, 70% of the housing units in Gaza have been either damaged or destroyed. Think about that. Unbelievable. 1.8 million people displaced. And right now, hundreds of thousands of children face starvation. The law is very clear. A section of the Foreign Assistance Act says, very straightforwardly, any country that denies American humanitarian aid to get through, should be investigated and, if true, defunded, right? In other words, a country that prevents American humanitarian aid from getting through is breaking the law. And right now, that's exactly what is happening. So we have asked the president to stop funding Israel so long as they break the law.
Now, when you did that proposal, and this relates back to a lot of your career in Congress, when you did that proposal, I think you got, I hope I'm right on this, that you got 9 Democrats to vote with you.
I think maybe a little bit.
Nine more. Or 10.
Yeah.
And then Rand Paul, the Republican, voted with you.
Yep.
And back when you were trying to audits and stuff like that, his father, Ron Paul, would sometimes vote with you. And you'd get it. Occasionally, you'd get a conservative.
Yep.
And the reason I bring this up is that when we talk about foreign policy, there is this bipartisan consensus, but there also are people who are conservatives and progressives, who are kind of outside of the party discipline, if you will, right, who are willing to raise these issues. You can build real coalitions.
Yeah, well, what that has a lot to do with is, as you know, the American Constitution makes it quite clear that it is the United States Congress that has the right to declare war. But most of the military action that takes place with the support of the United States and with our troops is never involves a declaration of war. It's something that presidents of the United States for many, many decades have been doing. And what many of us are saying, hey, if you want to go to war, fine. You come to the Congress and ask permission to do that. You just don't have the power as president, whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever. And that's something that some of the right-wing guys appreciate as well.
Let me talk about an element of the foreign policy debate in America that has frustrated you a great deal. And that is when people do rise up and say, you know, look, I think what we're doing is wrong. And we'll use the example of Gaza here. There are very powerful special interests that seek to punish them for doing that. As an example, that you've got members of the squad, people that you've worked with very closely, who've been targeted by AIPAC and by other groups to try and defeat them for re-election because they've stood up saying, you know, look, the killing has to stop in Gaza.
Well, what that is about, it's almost less about Israel and Gaza than it is about a very, very corrupt political system.
Exactly.
So you have, in the case of AIPAC, you have a group that contributes very heavily to the Democratic Party and Democratic members, an organization, a PAC, a super PAC, or subsidiaries of a super PAC, that contribute a whole lot to Republicans as well. I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, it doesn't matter. But the billionaires who fund these super PACs are not only concerned about protecting Israel's right to do whatever it wants to do, but also about protecting corporate interests. And you have a lot of wonderful members of the House of Representatives who have stood up for the working class, have taken on corporate interest, have also expressed their deep concern about what Israel is doing in Gaza. And what you're seeing, and this is the corruption of the American political system, is a super PAC which can accept as much money as billionaires are prepared to give them, now going to war against those individual members. And not only is that in itself terrible, because these are some of the best people in Congress. I'm going to do my best to try to protect them and defend them. But it sends a message. You know, if you're sitting there and you're concerned about what's going on in Gaza, do you really want to speak out and know that suddenly the next day there are going to be ads on television funded by billionaires attacking you and lying about you? So this is, you know, at the end of the day, we can talk about a whole lot of things. But money in politics and what Citizens United has done, and the fact that billionaires can spend unlimited amounts of money through super PACs, is probably the most dangerous problem facing American democracy.
And it's not just on Israel-Palestine. It's on a lot of foreign policy issues and on military budgets and things like that. Money in politics warps our discussions about the world and about our budgets, about everything that's going on.
Look, you have no idea about the amount of time that people spend raising money. And you really don't. People have no clue. In fact, you know, there are some members of the House and some members of the Senate who really are very determined to hold as many town meetings with the public as they can. They are the exception to the rule. I mean, actually going out, inviting members of a community to come in, raise questions, those are outstanding members of Congress. They are few. They are very, very rare. I would have to say that many members spend a lot more time at fundraisers with their wealthy friends, raising money for super PACs, et cetera, et cetera. That's the reality of American politics. And if we don't deal with that, that is how the oligarchy increases their power.
And this becomes an interesting thing, because that reality cuts people off in Congress, cuts members of Congress off from listening to...
You don't want to listen, of course.
They don't want to listen to the movement in this country. They don't want to listen to what people in the streets
are saying.
Why
do you want to, if you're sitting there as a normal human being, and many members of Congress are more than normal and they're smart, and if you understand that what somebody is telling you will get you into trouble, that will result in you losing the election, psychologically, where do you go? Do you really want to listen to what people say? Do you want to embrace what they're saying? You have to tune it out. And then you have to rationalize about why your corporate sponsors or your billionaire sponsors are really, you know, what they're telling you is really true, really makes sense in the deep sense of the world.
And there's been, in bringing us back to foreign policy, that's happened of late because it's been very powerfully striking since October 7th and the horrors that happened with Hamas's attack, but then in the aftermath with Israel's assault on Gaza, that there really is a movement that has built up in this country, a movement of Muslims, Jews, Christians, non-religious folks who have objected to U.S. policy. It's clearly out there. It's everywhere.
Well, in the polls, it's not only the demonstrations. Yeah. It's the polls that tell you, I think there was a poll, you know, and you know, some polls are good, some are not, but there are polls out there who say that a majority of the American people, overwhelmingly Democratic, a good number of Republicans, no longer think we should be giving money to Israel's right-wing government to continue this terrible war. Do I think members of Congress are listening to that? I don't think so. But on the other hand, what I would say is I think the pressure is building and more members understand in their hearts that what's happening in Gaza is just unacceptable.
Let's close off with a little bit about you in this regard. And one of the things about the book is that you're not one of those politicians who goes out and says, oh, here's my personal story. You don't do that a lot. You tend to focus more on the issues. But the book has quite a few anecdotes and you know, perspectives on where you come from. One of the things that I've seen with you over the years is an interesting thing. On the 4th of July up in Vermont, you tend to go to a number of small towns. And you go to 4th of July celebrations that are actually pretty classically patriotic events. The flags and the kids in the parade. You often march in the parades.
Oh, I love parades. I've probably gone to more parades. I've gone to many, many parades in every part of the state, and I love parades, actually.
And when you do that, I've seen you out with folks talking and being with them. And I think that it gives you a perspective. Americans are, in fact, quite patriotic, right? They love their country. Mm-hmm. But they're also willing to have real deep discussions about it. They're willing to love their country enough to ask it to be better than it is at times. And I guess I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, that, what you learned from that.
I'm not going to tell you that at parades we have these great policy discussions.
Well, sometimes in the park we do.
Sometimes you make.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what town meetings are about.
Yeah.
And Vermont, as you know, has a long history of town meetings. And Norman Rockwell, do you remember the Norman Rockwell painting? Mm-hmm. I have it in the front of my office in Burlington. It's this wonderful picture of a town meeting and a guy standing up and, you know, speaking. And I love that about Vermont. But to my mind, and, you know, when I ran for president, we did a whole lot of these things, just meetings. Get up, what's on your mind? Tell me what you think. And we don't do that enough. We just don't do that enough. And I think that's what a revolution in democracy is about, is allowing people, giving people the opportunity to talk about what they're experiencing, what they would like to see, and then having politicians actually listen to them and translate their pain into remedies. And that's what we're kind of lacking now.
And this is, in many senses, what this book is about. At the heart of this book is a lot of information, a lot of critique of what's going on, but also really an appeal for a different and a better politics, a politics that is reflective.
Right. I think it ends on an optimistic note that we are the wealthiest country in the history of the world. This country, through the American Revolution, began the entire movement toward democracy in modern world society. A lot to be very proud of. God knows we have struggled and with all kinds of problems, you know, from slavery and everything else. But there's a lot to be proud of as Americans. And I think we end the book on a note that says, if we can once again, or maybe for the first time, create the kind of vibrant democracy that we know we can create, where people are participating, are fighting for their ideas, we can transform this country and once again take our position in the global community as the moral leader of the world. And that's what I would like to see us do.
Not a bad goal. Senator Bernie Sanders, we've spoken quite a bit for the last few hours about different topics in this book, and particularly topics in the new paperback that's coming out. I'll let you close us off with just a thought about why you thought this was an important book to do, and also...
Well, I think it's an important book because these are admittedly very, very, very difficult times for our country and the world. And I think there are a lot of people who are kind of getting so overwhelmed and so depressed about the current situation that they're turning off their, you know, their brains and not wanting to engage in what's going on. It's just too painful, too difficult, too depressing. But that ain't a solution. Despair is not an option, especially with the coming election and the possibility that Trump could be elected president. I believe that at this particular moment in history, with all of this technology that's out there, we have the potential to actually do something that has never before been done in human history. And that is really utilizing this technology, create a society in which we wipe out poverty, which we lower the work week, which we significantly improve the standard of living of every man, woman, and child in this country. That's the goal. You know, instead of spending $900 billion a year on the military, let's have the best healthcare system in the world. Let's have the best educational system in the world. Let's lead the world in transforming our energy system. There's so much that we can do and we have the capability of doing. So the book ends on an optimistic note with some, you know, prescriptions as to how we might best go forward. And I think people will enjoy it.
Bernie Sanders, optimist. But also telling you it's okay to be angry about capitalism. Thanks to folks who've joined us for this conversation. And thank you, Senator, for taking the time to talk.
Thank you very much. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.